one of the interesting things about writers is we're all competing with each other, and yet we're all, particularly in, you know, in the conference setting, we're all more than willing to help each other.
Welcome to Angle on Writing, a podcast about writing, publishing, and book marketing. Greetings, writers. Today, I'm happy to be with a very prolific writer, a fantastic, with a PH, author. Welcome, Matt Palomary.
Thank you for having me, Lisa. Always a pleasure to collaborate with you.
Yes, and I have interviewed you before, and I will link to that interview in the show notes so people can listen to that. So I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach and ask you, so what's new?
What's new, my latest? Obviously, your newest book is your latest, your newest baby. People say, what's your favorite book? Well, it's always your newest. This is my 24th book. It's coming out on June 21st, the day that the conference opens, which is also the solstice. And it's called Ayahuasca, the Mother of All the Plants, and the Voice of Pachamama.
And so is this fiction?
Oh, no. This is very serious nonfiction.
Oh, wow. Okay. So because you never know what genre you're going to be publishing in. So
you are right about that. I'm a publicist nightmare and my own worst enemy because they can't stick me in any one category. But it keeps you from being bored. But some people know, or they don't, and I won't get into the nitty-gritty details, but ayahuasca is a visionary brew that's comes from the Amazon, and I've been working with it for about 25 years now. I'm getting ready to go to my 15th 10-day extended plant diet called a dieta in October. And without going into the nitty-gritty of the dieta, unless you wanted to, it's 10 days of very restricted diet. You roughly do ayahuasca, a ceremony, every other day. So you'll do 5 ceremonies in 10 days. They're usually nighttime ceremonies. And then if you've been at it for a long time like me, you'll do it once or twice by yourself during the day. Now, ayahuasca is literally prehistoric. So I started off with some of the myths from some of the tribes in the Amazon, because it has really murky origins. It is literally prehistoric. So I start off with some myths from some of the tribes who have been using it. And then I go into the first Western explorers that encountered it back in 1865, Richard Spruce, who was an English botanist. And then Richard Evans Schultes, who was the director of the Harvard Botanical Museum, who was a big, huge fan of spruce and his research, which was groundbreaking. And then I get into the first religions that came up out of it, which was in like 1920-ish. And then I get into how those have spread and became legitimate. And then all the way to the United States and all over the world into a Supreme Court case that made it actually legal under freedom of religion. Then every time when I go and doing the 10-day dieta, you do the ayahuasca, like I said, in the ceremonies, and every day you get a picture of a plant or plants. So each plant affects you in different ways. So the next part of the book, I did a chapter on each plant, separate plant, called teacher plants, or ayahuasca is the mother of the plants. So these, you know, in the jungle lore could be their children or whatever like that. They're all allies. They're all related, so to speak. So I do a chapter on each plant separate that I worked with. I do the botany, the taxonomy, all the technical stuff. And then the second half of the chapter is my experience with the plant. So I go through all the plants. Then I have a section on safe practices, physiology, the dangers, contraindications, and then I get into a whole thing on safe practices, what to follow up on, and then the last part is basically about integrating the experience. So it's very comprehensive. I've got some big names in the field who have given me endorsements who are actually very, very excited about it. One of them said it's the only book of its kind.
That sounds very interesting. Very, and it sounds like you've got a really good format, and just it sounds like it's going to be very easy to read. And so what's the, and since I'm assuming a lot of people who would be tuning in are creative people, they're writers and poets, and so is this, does it, do you talk much about inspiring creativity in it? Because I would think, some people say that this kind of visionary work will help your creativity. Is does it?
Yeah, it's totally changed my life. And I studied it for 10 years before I found it. So now I've technically been researching it for over 35 years. It took 10 years before I found it. And as I mentioned, I've been going into the jungle for 25 years. This will be my 15th 10-day dieta. And I've also spent time down there with a couple of tribes, learning their traditions also. Writers are on the edge in terms of freeing up their imagination. And there's a long history of psychedelic use. And of course, a lot of writers end up alcoholics. One, I won't go on about alcohol, but alcohol can free up inhibition. And, for me, in my case, I will admit cannabis really helps me write. I mean, I'd be stuck on a plot point sometimes for 3 days, pulling my hair out. And then I'll take one hit of weed and bang, it just starts to flow. Suddenly I would get three or four good pages out of it. So, the big part of writing, whether fiction or nonfiction, is allowing your imagination to flow freely. And things that stretch your imagination are conducive to creativity. And in this case, with the ayahuasca and the other plants, you really push the boundaries of your own consciousness and your own perception. You really go beyond the limits of anything you could even begin to imagine. And it frees you up. And then when you get into doing the writing, particularly with fiction, but like I said, it also applies to nonfiction. In terms of, one of the things of, I'll touch in a little more on fiction writing here. One of the things about fiction writing, what I tell my students all the time, is as a writer, it's up to us to put our audience there. So you become very aware of perception. And ayahuasca dieta is like a marathon in bending your perception every which way you can imagine. And your dreams and your visions and your waking life all blur together, which is the way indigenous people experience the world. So it gives you a subjective perspective that's different from anything else. And learning that subjectivity gives you a great strength when you're writing it down to put to put your readers there. My workshop is Fantastic Fiction with a PH, Literature of the Visionary, Supernatural, Metaphysical, Horror, Fantasy, and Science Fiction. When you're writing about fantastic worlds, let's say science fiction for an example, you have to work harder at world building. It's not like walking into a room and there's bookshelves behind you and blah, blah, blah. You're an alien outer space place where even the laws of physics are different. So in those fantastic genres, you have to work extra hard to world build and put your readers there in that reality, whatever it happens to be. So expanding my mind with all these experiences allowed me to expand it when I write. I've got a number of science fiction novels. I've got three short story collections. I've got historical fiction, supernatural thrillers, science fiction, horror novels. The freedom to let my mind go has been greatly expanded by my jungle experiences.
That's really cool. That's very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of people will love to read this book. You talk about the workshops that you teach, and I've known about you for 33 years, but I never really attended your workshop because I don't write in those genres. I write historical fiction, YA, that kind of thing, coming of age. And not until Marla Miller got me to go to the Southern California Writers Conference in San Diego. And there you did a pirate workshop, after hours workshop, where it was all genres. And so that's where I got to see that you are generally just a good writing teacher, no matter what the genre. You're a great editor and great writing teacher. And so, as the years went on, I did get to know you and actually worked out a deal where you got to edit my novel, or I got to have you edit my novel. And I was very grateful for all the wonderful things that all the things that I put in that I should have put in. I just want to give you a kudos for your editing. You want to talk about editing other people's work, or
Yeah, a little bit. I want to say your historical novel. What old stogies?
Whiskey
Is
and
it
Old Stogies.
Whiskey and Old Stogies? When I first heard it, when you first read it in my workshop, I was blown away because you really did a great job with the dialogue. And you captured an older world of bootleggers that modern people don't know. So you did a really great job, even before I did any work on it, of putting me there, putting the reader there. And in some respects, it's like an alien in a science fiction world because it was, I can't remember, forgive me, I was pre-depression or the 20s, or it was back historical. So you had to work a little harder at world building with things that people don't know. So in any fiction, regardless of what it is, you have to put your reader there, you have to put your audience there, and you have to create that world very thoughtfully. Years ago I was in a workshop and this lady was writing a science fiction novel, and she talked about the guy went and blasted the alien with his ray gun. And then she wrote, it smelled like roast beef. That totally pulled me out of the story. It destroyed it. I'm like, suddenly I'm in the kitchen with roast beef, right? It didn't work. It was not a good metaphor.
Oh.
So, just as an example, now when I wrote my historical novel, End Without Evil, it was first contact between the Jesuits and the Indians in South America. So you couldn't say anything. You couldn't say, like, faster than a speeding bullet, any of that. There was no conception of any of that. So it forced me to use natural metaphors in nature. Now, I did that to stay true to the voice and the reality. When it came out, it was published, reviewers were saying it was a beautifully written literary novel. And I'm like, wow, I hadn't even thought of that. I wasn't trying to write a beautifully written literary novel. I was trying to stay true to the voice and the reality of the character. So when you create in different, that's why I can edit any work, because the rules are the same. Maybe I'm a little more aware of alternate reality, so to speak, because of my background. But whether you're writing in the 20s or the 30s or the 40s or the 50s or modern day or whatever, you have to be relevant to that era. And there's all kinds of tricks, like what's going on historically at the time, what music happens to be playing, all those things you can do.
So you mentioned the person who had the metaphor that just didn't work. When that was pointed out to them, and then and also in your workshop, what you do a lot of read and critique it when you teach workshops. And so, how is it that you find people actually can handle criticism?
She didn't take it all that good. This is a long time ago. She didn't take it bad, but she was a newer writer. But you know this about me, and anybody who knows me has spent any time with me. You may not agree with anything I say, but I'm going to tell you straight up, here's what I honestly think. And I often tell people, look at this is my opinion. You can take it or leave it. I don't care. I'm not attached either way. But if you ask me, this is what I think. Now, mind you, it's an informed opinion. I've been writing for over 40 years. I've had great teachers, you know, through the conference, Ray Bradbury, Barnaby Conrad, all the great mentors, you know, Sid Stiebel, that I spent a lot of time with. I can go on and on with the list of names who were kind enough to inspire me and take me under their wing. But the point is, I'm going to tell you what I honestly think. And I've had different people tell me things I didn't want to hear, but I knew they were telling me their honest thought. And that's what I want to hear. And in my own case, you know, if I've been critiqued, I'll listen. If one people says some one person says something, maybe. If two people see the same thing, I got to pay attention to that. And of course, if three do, I got to change something, right? And one of the things I try to do, it gets harder as I've been gone further along in this, is I like some people, I want to hear people, how they react, people that who are not writers. I want to get that cold. They're not looking for adverbs or, you know, adjectives or punctuation. They're, does this work for you or not? You know? So I just say, this is my honest opinion. And generally speaking, 95% of the time, people really appreciate the fact that they're going to hear it straight from me. Again, they don't have to agree. I don't care if they listen to me or not. But one of the things I'll do is if I'm talking about a particular thing, let's say for argument's sake, somebody reads a piece and it needs better scene setting. When I'm finishing up the critiques, I'll do a little lesson on scene setting. And I'll use their work for an example. And, you know, in the same way, if they do something really good, like, wow, this is great characterization. You see the way they did this, that, and the other thing? Then that's also effective too. So I try to make all the comments, even though the one person is reading and getting the criticism. I really work to make it accessible to everybody. So one person reads, they're getting the criticism, but the whole class is learning from it, including me.
That's a really good point that if one person says something, then write it down. You don't necessarily have to go with it, but if you hear it again, and thing is too is maybe they say that, but maybe it's just changing two or three words.
Yeah.
Not may you know, it's not saying you have to rewrite the whole thing. You can just do some tweaks. I know one of my favorite advice that you gave in your, you write all sorts of genres, and one of your other nonfiction books is your fantastic fiction, which is I really recommend that book. And one of my favorite tips in there is that information kills drama. And
Yeah.
I see that too in books that I might be reading. It's like going, this is way too much information. Please get on with it. And so that's one of my favorite tips. Is there any other advice that you really wish people knew as people are getting ready to go to this conference or, it's summertime. So no matter what conference you're going to or what writing group you're going to, as your people are preparing their new writers, preparing their pages, what are things that they should be looking for in revision?
A few things. They should bring it as clean as they can. I've seen people who used to really annoy me. They would always come every year and bring their very best stuff and read the same very, very best stuff all over again. I always brought my worst stuff. But, you know, do the best you can with it. But bring your worst stuff. Get criticism. Also, I always encourage my students when you're critiquing somebody, it's really great to write down your comments and hand that person who read the comments, because it's overwhelming when you read in the beginning like that. Your baby's out there getting exposed, and people can be telling you important things, and you may not quite get them because you're just a bit overwhelmed. But if you go back later and look at your notes, then you can refer to them. The other thing, this is one of my pet peeves. I've seen people come to the conference and then disappear into their room, and they don't go to workshops and this and that. And I'm like, what are you doing in your room? Oh, I'm working on my book. I said, what are you doing the other 51 weeks of the year? Forget it. Bring your stuff here. The other thing I recommend, because I killed myself in the beginning, is when you go to the conference, pace yourself. I tried to do everything in my first year and I got totally killed. I just destroyed myself. I was a basket case. So somewhere on mid-conference, if you can, maybe take a night off or just take a break, give yourself a breather. The other thing is that the information you get is very, very dense. So I recommend that when people are done with the conference, just go home and kind of forget about writing for maybe a week or so. You're all pumped up with a bunch of other nutty writers like yourself. You're really relating. You found the tribe. And then you go back out into the world and you're trying to articulate to people what a great time you had. And they're looking at you like, huh? Right? They don't get it. They weren't, immersed in that wonderful tribe. So it's always a good idea to give yourself time to integrate afterwards. And one of the best ways to do it is just to forget about your book and everything else for at least a week, because your subconscious is at work. In my case, and I sort of indirectly learned this from Ray Bradbury. Now, I want to finish the first draft. I set the book aside. I don't even think about it for a month. I don't look at it. It doesn't even exist. Then when I pick it up after a month and I do that first revision, oh yeah, that's hopping, man. And when I finish that revision, I'll set it aside for another month and forget about it. And then pick it up again after that month and hit it and get a good revision out of it. That time to integrate the experience is really important. So, generally overall thing is really pace yourself and give yourself time. You'd be amazed at how much work your subconscious really, really does. And that's by just leaving it alone and letting it do its thing, because it's working, whether you think so or not.
Well, that's great. You went right into my next question and already answered half of it. And that is so that's great advice for attending conferences, 'cause I've heard you say that before, as far as when you first started attending this conference and other conferences, you tried to do everything. So as people are preparing to go to conferences this summer and fall, do you have other tips for how to navigate a writing conference?
Yeah, find out, aside from workshop leaders, find out the people who have been there before and make friends, because they're more than willing to guide you. I'm in this really weird getting older proud daddy moment, because a lot of the workshop leaders were students of mine. Lorelei Armstrong ran the Pirates. She was my princess of darkness way back from the beginning. Norm Thoming, Trey Dowell. I'm always afraid I'm going to forget somebody. Rick and Nick, Rick Shaw and Nick Deitch, now reading Pilots. They were with me for 10, 12, 15 years, right? All of my core people are now leaving me. Wah! But I'm happy they're teaching. So they already have experience. So newer people, if they find out and they can tell pretty quickly who has been there before with some experience, it's kind of an added thing. They'll tell you, oh yeah, you should go to this person, they're really good. Or, oh, what you're writing, that's really good for that person's workshop, that kind of a thing. Because one of the interesting things about writers is we're all competing with each other, and yet we're all, particularly in the conference setting, we're all more than willing to help each other. So there's a real brotherhood slash sisterhood with writers that the conference really, really embodies. I consider the conference to be my family.
Yes, actually, I know at the last conference, at the opening night dinner, I was sitting with B. Blauser, who has a really great historical memoir, and she said she was looking around and she said, "You know, this feels just like a family reunion."
Yeah. No, it is. It really is. It's family. I mean, like I said, I've been 38 years with the conference now.
And one of the great things too is if people are signing up or they haven't figured out if they want to sign up yet, it's they've got a great Facebook group. I love that the Santa Barbara Writers Conference Facebook group.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a great way to kind of get to know people.
And you can on Facebook, you can, independently message them too and ask their advice.
Yeah,
Wow.
that's one of the reasons too why I've been doing these last few bit videos with people who are specifically involved is to let people get to know these people who are either presenting workshops or they're doing one-on-one consulting like what I do to let people get to know them. That way they have a little kernel of something that if they happen to end up sitting down next to them, they might have an opening for a conversation or something.
One of the things that's important is through the years of the conference, there was always some years we do it now, sometimes we don't. But for most of the conference, there was always one day that was a staff party. Used to be at the Conrad's house. The big name writers would come, the movie stars would come, celebrities, workshop leaders. We'd have a great staff party. Well, then a lot of the people in Montecito started throwing more parties. Big parties. Until there was like almost one every day of the week. So then what happened is that all the people who were at the conference and there was no staff or workshop leaders there, and they were kind of there by themselves. And part of the conference is being accessible. So they stopped doing all the extra parties because we want to be accessible. Anybody sees me at the conference anywhere and they want to have a one-on-one with me, grab me. And I'll say, I'll do it now, or meet me at so this, meet me at 11:30 at this place, or blah, 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 to be accessible so people. And one of the great things over the years, even with all the famous people that used to come, I'd sit there and have breakfast with Charles Schulz, right? Monty's dad, Sparky, right? And we I mean hang out, right? I was blessed to spend a lot of time with Ray Bradbury, right? And hear him tell stories about writing Moby Dick with John Huston, and hanging out in the bar with Elmore Leonard or Steve Allen or Jonathan Winters, just hanging out.
Yeah.
To be in their presence and make jokes and be one-on-one instead of all the celebrity fanboy or fangirl stuff and all that. And, looking back for me over all these years, those guys all really took me in as one of their own. And I was shocked for like, what are they seeing me? Do they know where I come from? And over the years, as I find myself now in that, for lack of better words, that elder position, I realized that they recognize themselves in me in terms of, the obsession and the drive to continue writing and perfect your craft. And it meant a lot to be with them and hang with them, and all that stuff. I call it carrying the torch.
Yes.
I'm carrying it forward and I'm being there for newer writers to give them. I could never be Ray Bradbury, but I'm in some respects I'm filling his shoes.
Yeah.
Just like Barney Conrad, just like Fred Klein, right? Senior vice president, right, of Random House, was he? And he was the ombudsman, right?
Bantam Publishing. Yeah, he was
Phantom, yeah.
Bantam. And
He,
yeah, he was the ombudsman, but and now you're the ombudsman.
exactly. I can't even fill those shoes, but
But
yet I've been around that long.
so you're besides your workshop, your 5-day workshop, you're
Yeah.
also going to be doing moderating one panel and you're on another panel. And what else are you doing this year?
Yeah, I do over the course of the year, I do a lot in the background with Grace. That's why she made me the ombudsman. And of course, I can't say that without saying the joke. I call it the Ombudsman because I
Oh,
really love the Budsman. That's my
yeah.
joke. I've done a ton of podcasts and radio shows and television shows. I've done maybe a dozen audiobooks of my own. So I'm in the middle of a podcast panel. In fact, you're on it with me. You and I, you're on, you, yeah, we're bringing you into the crew there. So we do podcasts, audiobooks, voiceover acting. I've done all those. And I set up my own little studio at home. So it's a good space for me to be right in the middle because I do all of them. We have, is it Lois? I can't remember her last name. Lois does the podcast
Phillips.
part. Phillips, yeah. And of course,
Yes, done.
Claudia Dunn and Yvette,
Yeah.
they
Killer.
have this, I mean, I call Claudia though, she's the Gucci and I'm the ghetto.
Yeah.
She's really very talented and very high level. So, but I'm in there with all them because I've done everything. And then because I've written in so many genres, Grace has me moderating a nonfiction panel. And then before, I think it's before the nonfiction panel, I'm on another sort of a marketing group thing with Rachel Sarah Thurston.
Yeah, she's yeah, it's a kind of an author round table
Yeah,
where
author roundtable, right.
yeah.
So I'm there with that.
It's kind of like the way I understand it, because I'm going to be on that too, is it's kind of like a panel, but they don't want to confuse people with the panels that they're doing
Yeah.
mid-afternoon. So it's more of a kind of a Q&A.
Yeah, a round table. All right, tease them. I don't see any round tables here. Right. But yeah, so there is that. And part of that is being accessible. And I also, in terms of my efforts to stay honest, I like the people to really know the realities of writing business because it's changed radically,
Oh, yes.
especially in the
Total.
past 10, 20 years.
Well, that's the thing, is you're talking about, Ray Bradbury filling his shoes or filling some of these other shoes, where one of the things that makes that hard is that it's a totally different world in publishing these days. So it's, and there are a lot of conferences that do talk about the new, independent publishing and the new ways of doing publishing and stuff. But whereas this conference just kind of touches on that a little bit and is mainly, I think, mainly focuses on craft, don't you think?
Well, we were always craft focused. Back in the day, so to speak, it was all about craft. And we had all the big names because Bernie Conrad had all the famous friends. And back then, literary agents were sort of the only way to get published. So we'd spend the week focused on craft. On Tuesday, I think it was Tuesday, they would have the agents panel.
They still do.
Yeah. But then it was like, really the thing, the agents and editors panel. And then you could do the one-on-ones and all that. And then they'd have the wine and cheese party where you can kind of schmooze with the agents. Right? But that was it because that was the way into getting published. But over time, as this whole self-publishing has evolved, everything has changed. I worked in publishing for years, prior to all that, and I didn't quite make the connection in the beginning. I worked on some of the very first word processors doing research and development. I was a customer engineer for a computer typesetting company back in the 80s. At the time, every printer, every newspaper, financial printers, check printers, real estate listings, they all used our gear until the 1200 dot per inch laser printers came in. Right? And I even worked on these word processors that were before the PCs. So I already knew all this stuff about layout and what is a font and points and all that. I already knew all that. So when I started easing into self-publishing, something clicked. And I realized, crud, I already know all that stuff, right? So I think you might have been a little bit a part of it, but some years back, it's all getting to be a blur to me now. But some years back, I did, I think I called it, Guerrilla publishing in the 21st century.
Yes.
That was the first thing of that nature that wasn't fully craft. I hit on everything. I hit on, Ernie Witham was like, dude, I couldn't even keep up with you. You had so many stuff, right? But I hit on podcasting and blah, all that. I hit on that. And Grace was aware of the shifting in publishing. So from that beginning of that, we started to develop this whole sort of secondary track, which includes audiobooks and podcasts. None of those were realities back when the conference started out. There was radio and TV, that was it. And you even sort of part of that with the Literary Gumbo, right? And now I'm doing all this stuff, and then like I see people coming along, they're like 3 or 4 years behind where I was, because I was in really on the edge of all that stuff. And now I do everything. I write everything and I do everything. And it's valuable information for people getting into it because it's all a double-edged sword. There's more opportunity to get published like this, but there's also a gazillion more people competing with you. And you can't get, like with the big publishers, they had all the distribution and all that. Now, don't quote me on these numbers, but I was looking recently. I think something like 11,000 books are published every day, right?
Yeah.
And if you're not a celebrity and you don't have anything going, you're going to really have a rough time of it. I'm lucky in a way because I was published prior to all that, more along traditional lines, and so I already have a following. Not huge. I'm not a bestseller, but I have some dedicated fans. I have a following. And now I'm branching out. And so I have a little bit of an edge over newer people. People come to the conference, they go, oh, that's the ombudsman guy, the fantastic fiction guy. That even gives me a little bit promotional edge that somebody who's coming for the first time doesn't.
That's true. That's
Yeah.
very.
But one of the exciting things about this, aside from the drudgery of being a writer, is that anything can happen,
That's very true.
I made a query and got on the Coast to Coast radio show. I wasn't even going to do it. And my buddy's like, do it, man. What do you got to lose? And sure enough, I sent in the thing and forgot about it. 2 days later, a producer called me. Now I've been on 7 times. I'm a returning guest.
And that is a huge market. I have a client who has also been on that, and it's like it's a huge show that just makes book sales spike.
Yes, exactly. It's changed over the years, but right now there are 2.5 million live listeners and they record it. And I got a guy who records it for me and takes out all the commercials. And then I post that up on the internet and that gets listens, on and on and on and on and on and on. It just keeps going like that, right? And like you said, it's a very prestigious thing. I always get a nice spike in book sales. I love them. They love me. But I can't really promote any fiction on there. I always make the joke, I'm part of the UFO Bigfoot crowd. Those are what their listeners are. But it's the most widely listened to show in its time slot in the country.
Yes. Yeah. Well, because a lot of people, it's for the people who can't sleep. It's
Yeah,
like,
all night truckers.
yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
But people discover me that way.
Yes.
And then, I'll sell some of my fiction too.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's the way it is when you have a platform, building a platform. If your name is out there, it's like, oh, I want to, put in this guy's name on Amazon, and maybe not the book you're look that you listen to the radio show and they said he put out. That doesn't might not come up, but you notice all the other books that come up and like, oh, I want to read that. So it's a great
Yeah.
way to promote and build your platform.
That's what you got to do. And as I mentioned earlier, it's tougher for me because I'm writing so many different genres. What would you call me? Oh, he's science fiction, horror, nonfiction, sacred geometry, psychedelics, visionary, jungle plants. I got two memoirs about going to the jungle. So I'm they can't just put me like my buddy David Brin, the science fiction writer. Go to science fiction, boom, there's David Brin. Right? Where's Matt Palomary? God, he's all over the star. He's scattered, right? Not that I would ever compare myself to David. He's a great buddy, you
Well,
know.
thank you so much. This has just been it's been really cool to catch up, and I hope that is there anything else that you're looking forward to at the conference, or any other advice you want to give to any would-be writers or publishing people?
Come to the conference, find your tribe. Because aside from going to workshops with people who are knowledgeable in what they do, you're in with kindred spirits who really understand your creative insanity. And they understand you in ways that maybe your normal family members may not. So it is home, and that camaraderie and being with everybody really can spin you up and motivate you for the rest of the year going forward. Like that. There's nothing like that family feeling, the energy to be better and be as good as you can and excel at your craft. So come on down, come to my workshop, go to all the other workshops. I always like to say, check out all the different food groups. You
Yes.
know, you may go somewhere and not think it's for you and discover something that you didn't. The last little thing I'll say is when I went from attending as an attendee, and I was the youngest workshop leader for 15 years. I'm not so young anymore. But when I started teaching as opposed to attending, my writing went up multiple levels. And it dawned on me that all of my students are my teachers. And we're all teachers to each other, no matter who you are. Okay, I'm a workshop leader and I'm an ombudsman, but I'm still learning from everybody.
That's true.
Yeah, so we're all learning from each other. It's not that I'm a better writer than other people. Maybe I just started sooner than they did, so I know the path because I was on the trail some years before they were. But we're all there for each other. We're all peers, and it's great to be part of the family. So come join the family. Come on down.
Sounds great. Well,
Yeah.
thank you, and I look forward to seeing you then.